Hey, welcome back to the No One Fights Alone podcast. Brad Shepherd, Max Morgan. Max, my friend, how are you, man?
Good, buddy. How are you?
I'm doing great, man. Good.
Do you want to see the coolest thing ever?
I do.
Look at this that I just got.
And the put light, up in my No office. One Fights Alone light. You're pretty proud of that.
Right? I'm pretty proud of it. I'm official now.
You are official.
I am official.
That's covering the veteran side. Austin got the law enforcement, so he made me get the fire guys. I do love my fire guys, but you're covering green. We got green, red, and blue now. And I love the light, man. It looks awesome.
I was excited. I put it up last night and couldn't wait for today to show it off.
I know we're recording on Valentine's Day. I hope you have, even though we'll release this at a later date, but I hope you have something great planned for your special Valentine who brought you a fucking sandwich while right before we started recording.
Right? Of course. I mean, I figured out last night at about 9 o'clock it was Valentine's Day today, so I got right on it.
Oh, you're spot on, man.
Yeah.
You're all
absolutely.
Over it.
I'm all over it.
Yeah.
How are you?
Man, I'm good. It's, navigating some of my parents' health stuff, but life is good, man. We're fixing to start road showing some conferences, and that's what I love. I enjoy doing it.
I don't want to hear about your bad Oklahoma weather. So, I mean, we got hammered really yesterday, and then where I live, it wasn't bad. I mean, a little bit of snow this morning, but as I went up the canyon to Chateau this morning, holy cow, those guys got absolutely hammered.
They did.
Up at Chateau. I couldn't believe how much snow was up there. It was just, schools were like hours and hours delayed. You had all these people out in tractors trying to clear their driveways and everything. I'll bet they got 18 to 24 inches of snow up there. Just hammered.
I will have to say the pictures you sent me at the facility at Chateau were beautiful, even though it was 2 foot of snow.
It is beautiful.
It really was beautiful.
Yeah.
Well, hey, our guest today coming on, wow, what a great interview we had. What a great conversation we had about yoga.
Right? Right? I mean, guys can do yoga.
Guys can do yoga.
Yeah.
I've done yoga.
I've done it.
Yeah. It's amazing. I'm a practitioner of meditation, more than I am yoga. I don't do yoga as much, but Vance Rowe coming on has more than just a yoga story. He's talking about, yoga saving his life.
Yeah. I loved it. So neat hearing his story, hearing about yoga and other things too, though, you know, a combination of all kinds of things to help him out. Sleep we dove into sleep pretty hard in this one, and I loved it. It's a phenomenal topic.
Such a great topic. Yeah, for sure. Well, without any hesitation from here on, let's dive into the podcast. Thank you, everybody, for listening, and have fun listening to Vance Rowe.
Welcome to the No One Fights Alone podcast. This podcast is dedicated to mental wellness for first responders and beyond. Through powerful stories, personal experiences, and expert insights, we explore the challenges and triumphs of maintaining resilience in the face of adversity. Together, we remind you, no one fights alone.
Welcome back to the No One Fights Alone podcast with your host, Max Morgan, and I, Brad Shepherd. We're happy to be here and have a guest on that we've been trying to get him on for a while. The majority, I'll own that. That is my fault for not getting you on sooner, but we've been trying to do this for a while. Vance Rowe with Yoga Rescue, who's a 20 plus year police officer and staring at retirement here real quick. I love that for you. Hope we talk about that here in a little bit, but he's going to talk to us today about yoga for first responders. Vance, thanks for coming on the No One Fights Alone podcast. So glad you're here, man.
Awesome. Thank you guys. I appreciate you having me.
Wife, Amy, of 21 years and very supportive. I have to say, we listened to a previous podcast and you just talk so highly of her and her support. So I hope her part of your story involves that as well and how important that was in your journey. So,
oh, for sure.
Yeah.
Yep.
So you're hailing from right now. You're sitting in Maryland, correct?
I'm in Ocean City, Maryland, and that's where I did my police and my dispatcher career too. We live in the jurisdiction, and just to give everybody like a geographic landmark, we are like 5 blocks from the Delaware line, like literally where Delaware and Maryland meet on the Atlantic Ocean. That's right where we are.
Nice.
Nice.
Well, I'm in Oklahoma, Vance, and Max is in Utah right now, covered up in about 2 foot of snow.
Oh,
Yeah, we got hammered last night, so.
okay.
And Brad tries to say that it's cold in
It's cold in
Oklahoma.
Oklahoma. Actually, we did have an ice storm 2 days ago. There was a sheet of ice everywhere. That was fun. But Vance, I want to kind of start back from the beginning. I just want to give you the mic for a little bit and give us a little bit of a backstory on this journey that you've been on, because it's fascinating. And I want the listeners to hear
Sure.
A lot of the backstory about
Sure.
how you arrived to this. You just didn't land on the yoga mat and say, "Oh, this is for me." There's a lot to your story.
To go back to maybe the beginning, I grew up in Baltimore, Maryland, and I would spend a lot of time at the beach in Ocean City. So that's about a 3 hour drive. My mom and my grandparents would both bring me down here a lot. So as far as like my professional career, it actually starts when I'm in college, and I went to college outside of Philadelphia. And after my first year there, I actually started working for the police department. So at the time I was 19, and I was a meter maid for 2 summers, and then became a police officer. And I was a summer police officer for 3 years. And this is all still while I'm in college.
Was that a
So
by
I had an
chance
interesting year.
job? Was that just a by chance job, or did you have every intention of going into law enforcement and starting with a meter maid?
Well, so it's funny you say that. So when I was in high school and I graduated in 1995, the movie The Fugitive was really
Oh yeah.
big at
Harrison
that
Ford.
Love
Point.
that show.
And I went into college as a political science major because I wanted to be a US Marshal, and I wanted to just like
Oh
track
yeah.
down people. And I'm like, this is
Tommy Lee
super
Jones
cool.
it up.
That's right. And then after I had done maybe 2 summers in Ocean City, and like the idea of the municipality, the smaller rather than like a national service. So I switched to criminal justice, and I went that track. I actually did my college internship in the Ocean City Police Department too, before just kind of deciding to make my life here on the Eastern Shore of
I
Maryland.
love that. Man, you already had it in your mind. You were going into this. You just didn't know where yet. Yeah.
I didn't know
Yeah.
where.
Yeah.
I didn't know where. I was like, I want to get into law enforcement. I didn't entirely know where. So, I mean, early part of my career, very similar to probably anybody else. We worked a lot. We all hung out together, like all the cops, and then all the cop wives and stuff like that. I mean, well, I know we'll talk about drinking later on, but when I look back on it now, I probably didn't have a very healthy relationship with it at the time. We would work 5 or 6 days a week, and then whatever days we had off, we would always, hit the bar, and I'd be one of the last ones standing, and just kind of the way it was. And then you went back to work, and then you did it all over again. But it was just the way that we blew off steam. And so for the first couple of years of my career, I was just, busy, work life. And then in my profession, in my, sorry, my personal life, I started getting involved in being on the union executive board. So I was doing this stuff not just when I was actually getting paid for it, but when I was kind of not being paid too. So it was eating up a lot of my time. I got recognized very early on as somebody that was bright and had a lot of initiative. So that just meant I
Sure.
got more work. My friend calls it the curse of
Yep.
competency. When I got promoted to corporal, and this is in 2012, that's when some of my rough patches begin. And I can't point to one incident and say this is the day things changed for me, and that it was after being involved in this or seeing this that the next day the world didn't look the same. Mine just didn't work like that. Mine was years and years and years of different cumulative traumas that just kept piling up on top of each other. My working hours didn't help me because I was at the time working like 60 hours a week. Like anybody else would probably tell you, we have good bosses and we have bad bosses, and I had a particularly bad boss at the time. So that didn't help me at all. I had gotten heavily involved into our polygraph, what's the word I want to look for? I guess polygraph group. And I was literally a one-man group because I was our first polygraph examiner. And what I didn't realize was, when I got into it, I thought it was going to be like you see it on TV. There's going to be like a bright, shiny light. People are going to be like pounding on the table. And I'm going to be like, tell me the truth. And it was just going to be that easy. What I didn't realize was like, the soft approach was really how you were going to get people to talk. And what I didn't really realize at all is there's an awful lot of people that, number one, applying to the police jobs that have had something awful happen to them in their life. And then I was becoming the first person that they ever told about it. And then there's a lot of people that don't belong in law enforcement that just thought they could get through, and they had done some awful things. So for whatever reason, a lot of that stuff started to stay with me. So around it's about 2016 at this point, and I'm working like 60 hours a week for about 9 months a year. And it just catches up to me. And I come home after working a midnight shift, and it's in June, and I tell my wife that I don't want to be a police officer anymore, that I can't fathom doing this anymore. And at that point, I was 9 years from retirement. And she wasn't like that's dumb. She was like, we can do this, but you just can't quit today. And she had said, look, if you can just make it through the summer, and if you can just make it through next spring, do your polygraphs, by next summer we can have you out. And I'm like, sounds like a good plan. So what happens is I don't ever get there. I get a an on-duty injury in October 2016 that ruptures my patellar tendon in my left knee, and I never go back to full duty. And the reason that I don't is even though having my knee reconstructed, I have nerve damage that makes my left foot burn all the time. And what happens to me is, this thing that I put so much love and attention into, and that whenever they called me and said, hey, can you do this? And I always said yes, it was gone. And I wasn't going to wear a uniform anymore. I wasn't going to wear a badge anymore. And I didn't realize the actual impact of that. And it's not until like later on that somebody actually goes through and is like, well, you were grieving. I'm like, what do you mean? And I thought, when people talk about grief and they talk about grieving, I think about like losing a person, not losing a job. So that it didn't make sense to me. Now, keep in mind, this is my, 2017, 2018 brain, of I'm just mad all the time. And I'm mad all the time because I had all these skills that I had acquired. I wanted to work, but at the time I had supervision that was telling, they were taking things away from me and they weren't allowing me to really do anything. And there was no plan for what to do with me. Look, we didn't have a medical retirement at the time. Like most agencies would say, yeah, 66 and two thirds and I'll go about my life. Well, we didn't have that. And, so it's just kind of sitting in this limbo of, well, you can't do this, but we're not going to let you go either. So we're just going to let you sit here in the middle. And that really got tough for me. And so I'm living most of my life in this just kind of angry state. And I felt like I was getting hot, and I felt like my fuse was really, really short. And the way that I combated that was I would come home every single night and drink. And most people, they would have never known that I had any issues. It's not like I came to work smelling like it or showing up late or missing assignments, anything like that. It just it was every night. I drank until I literally would pass out. And it just got to be worse and worse, kind of in like 2018, 2019, as my workers' comp hearing had closed out. And I really was like, oh, well, it's really over, but I still can't get my employer to really make a decision as to what to do with me. This is the time that I actually start having the feelings of wanting to take my own life. And I really don't know what to do with it. I really don't. And I'm like, who am I going to tell this to? This is awful. And at the time I had been a CIT instructor. So I'm teaching other police officers how to deal with people in mental crisis. And, you know, the first two questions that we ask people are, you know, are you thinking about killing yourself? And when they say yes, do you have a plan? And what are you supposed to do when you're the one that's teaching? And I can answer yes to both of those. So I didn't have a day picked out, but I knew exactly how I was going to do it. And so then there's two events in my life, and you brought up my wife Amy, but she plays a pivotal role in this. There's two events that really changed the trajectory of my life. And the first one is, there is a police officer that I worked with in the city of Salisbury, who took his own life in November of 2018. And the reason that I say that event does something to me is that I go to his funeral and I see the way that it rocks the Salisbury Police Department. It rocks the city of Salisbury, like the downtown community. And it impacts me because I'm having the same thoughts at the time. And that's the point that I get scared enough that I actually say it to my wife for the first time. And she had no idea. I mean, she knew that I was going through a rough patch. She knew that I was mad. She knew that I was kind of like almost like an exposed nerve, but she had no idea where my head was. So that was the first time that I talked to her.
I want to jump in here, Vance, because I feel like we're fixing a transition to something really powerful with a conversation with your wife. But before that, if you don't mind me asking a couple questions about,
shoot,
in my experience, I'm not a suicidologist, but in my experience, when people have so much pain and hurt and loss that they feel like there's no other alternative to living life than to take their own life, that's when you look at foundationally, okay, these are much bigger and broader than what I really thought they were. At some point in there, you're looking at this and saying, what is wrong with me? Why am I, you know, can you expound a little bit on that? I mean, are you in this time period, are you aware enough to realize that these things are the mountains they are? I know you've alluded to therapy revealed a lot later, but in this building up to this time, and you even, I'll take you even back to 2012, where you said you wanted to quit, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I actually, the way I looked at it was I was very deep in a hole, and I had no idea how I would ever get out of that hole. That no matter how many times that I try to climb up the wall, there was no traction and it was just dirt falling. And I could not see a way out of it. And to be fair, the way that it started, as far as like the suicidology part of it, was I would go to bed at night and just hope I didn't wake up. And because at least this would be over, and that's all I wanted. I'm not going to tell you that I wanted to be dead.
Right.
I just didn't want to deal with this anymore. Right. And I was just so frustrated, and that's really where it came from. You know, what's later diagnosed as both depression and anxiety. Mm-hmm. That was my frustration. That's how it came out. I wasn't like boohoo sad, wrap myself up in a blanket and stay there for 3 weeks.
Right.
That's just not the way my depression came out. Mine came out as anger, and it was just sheer frustration. And the only way that I knew how to calm myself down was alcohol.
How did that conversation go? I'm interested with your wife. I mean, I was in a very similar circumstance where the drinking, you know, tell you I blacked out. Now my wife and I had been separated at the time. But yeah, I mean, drinking till a blackout and the suicidal thoughts. And then I had a brother that died from suicide right in the middle of all this. And so I got mad at him because I was like, wait a minute, I'm trying to work on my stuff. Why couldn't you work on yours? And so I was mad at him for years, you know, but I never, it didn't come to my wife until a while later, till I'd already started to get help. Cause I didn't know how to have that conversation with my wife. I'm interested how that conversation with you and your wife went.
So I can still remember it pretty vividly. I was out on a walk with the dogs and like, it wouldn't stop. It wouldn't shut off in my mind. And she gets home and I grabbed her and we went in the bedroom and I'm like, I have something to tell you. Like, I need to tell you something. And I tell her and she's incredibly supportive. And she tells me flat out, she's like, I had no idea. But she also is like, all right, well, let's see what we're going to do about this. So the first thing we did is we actually get a hold of my family care doctor. And we talked to her about it. And at the time, I was on a lot of medications. I am not making an excuse for this, but there was a lot of different medications that I was on for nerve pain. And if it's given in high enough dosages, it may help with your nerve pain. So that may have had something to do with it. But the other part of
and
it
just
is,
for our listeners' sake,
sorry,
Vance, I was just going to say to remind our listeners here, we're talking about an injury. You've encountered something extremely difficult to navigate with this, this injury, right? Yeah.
Right.
Sorry.
And then the other part is, you know, the medicines that I'm on, every single one of them says, do not drink alcohol with this.
Yeah.
I do it every day. And I wasn't like having,
that's for other people.
It was
not for me.
Right. I don't got to worry about this part. So we do that and some medications are modified. And I hadn't been to therapy at that point in years. So I start back in the therapy realm. But it's not real intensive, but I don't tell anybody else. I only tell Amy and I tell our family care doctor. That's it. If I got to go back and talk to that guy in 2018 and be like, hey, a couple years from now, you're going to talk publicly about this and you're going to share these secrets that you have right now. I mean, like, you must be crazy. Anyway, so we start down that path and, kudos to Amy once again, because she wasn't, like really, really overbearing on me at that point. Like, she knew I had this thought and she could tell when I felt down, like we'd be on the phone, that she would text me a little bit more or she would call me cause she wanted to hear me. But you know, she didn't worry constantly, if that makes sense. She was a support, but not a nag. So I'm still drinking and we had had this conversation. And this conversation a couple times, she was like, look, I'm worried. And I don't want to take care of you. Cause I would get drunk at like at a bar or at a friend's house, like to the point where I'd have to be taken care of. And she's like, you know, this just isn't what I signed up for. And, I was trying to prove to myself that I didn't really have a drinking problem. So I would stop for a little while. Like I would stop for a week or I'd stop for a month. So here's event number two. So in November of 2019, we are at a vacation with like eight of our friends. So there's a bunch of us. And at that point I hadn't had a drink in 6 weeks. And I thought, I'm not an alcoholic. I'm good. So, you know, I obviously can keep it at bay. So I remember us even having the conversation, like, are you drinking? And I'm like, yeah, I mean, I'll be fine. It's 2 days. And I mean, I made up for all the lost time is the best way I can put it. So this time it's a little different. I don't think she knew what to do. And so she takes videos of me and she takes photos of me, of what I look like when I'm drunk and I'm acting like just an idiot. And the next morning she shows them to me and she says, look, man, we got to talk. And it wasn't, it wasn't like messing with me. It was literally like, I am very concerned about you.
How did you take that?
And better than you'd think. here's why I say that. So, I was so deeply embarrassed that this woman that I've now, at that point, I had been with for 20 years and we had been married for like 18 or 19. I don't want to disappoint her. And I mean, just the tone, like I had absolutely done that. And, I just didn't ever want to have this talk again. and how do I not have this talk again? Okay, well, I'm just not going to drink tomorrow. And I'm like, how hard could that be? But if I don't drink tomorrow, then we don't have to have this talk. And then it just kind of, I started to string some days and weeks together. Now, what's funny, and I had never thought of this. So when you asked me how did I take it, I didn't know I had a choice there. And here's what I mean. In our relationship, when one of us comes to the other one and is just like, look, we got to talk about something, we've always had the other person is like listening and right there. And 2 years later, I'm doing a podcast and they were the first ones that ever asked me the question, like, what if you had just been like, I don't have a problem. What's wrong with you? And I had never thought of that. I had honestly never even considered that I would fly off the handle and be like, I don't have a drinking problem. You have a drinking problem. And just, you know, I mean, like what, I like, where does our relationship go at that point? So that just wasn't an option to me. You know, this woman that I love and respect is like, dude, you're a mess. Okay. Well, I got to do something. And it's, please understand. It's not like it came out of left field. It's not like I didn't know that there was a problem. I mean, every day I'd wake up and my eyes would be really sensitive to light and my belly would be all messed up for the first couple hours of the day. I mean, that's not normal. So I didn't intend to quit forever. I literally was like, I don't want to have this talk anymore. And I would have people talk to me in the beginning stages of sobriety. And they were like, oh, you know, you think you'll ever drink again? And I used to always tell people, yeah, just not yet. Because I didn't want to have to have this conversation with like, hey, I don't think I can. I honestly think it's really bad for me. And nobody understood that. And especially people that I used to drink with, because if I have a problem, maybe they have a problem. And so unfortunately, you know, I have lost friends out of it. It's like, there's certain people that don't know how to talk to me anymore, that we would hang out, for lots of hours before, but now it's weird. And that's fine. They'll figure it out at some point, but it's not up to me. Sure. for them to figure it out. So those are the two events that happened that significantly changed the trajectory of my life. So where yoga comes in, which it's not like, you know, like I mapped all this out, like I'm going to stop and then I'm going to start getting real bendy and stretchy. And then I had never gone into a yoga studio before. And it's within a couple of days of Amy having this conversation with me that I go to a studio for the first time. And the whole reason I hadn't been to a studio before was it was because of me, because I thought I wasn't good enough. And I thought that people were going to like point and laugh at me, when that's not at all what was going to happen. And it's like I was my own worst enemy and I was saying all these horrible things to myself, but nobody else would ever say those to me. So anyway, I go to a yoga studio for the first time and I have this immediate connection with everybody else in the room as soon as you start doing it. And I didn't realize how badly I needed community at that time, but that's exactly what I got. Within the first 30 days, I came home and I told Amy that I was going to teach this to people like me. And I had a teaching background from the police world. Like I had done that for our summer police academy people. I had done it for full-time police academy people. I'm used to talking in front of people. It's just, this is a different topic. So my yoga journey is a little more accelerated. And So 6 months into my yoga journey, I'd signed up for teacher training, and here we are now. So I've only been practicing yoga like 5 years, and I've been a teacher for four. But what I found, other than, yeah, you get a little bendy and a little stretchy, is it allowed my mind to slow down. That was the important thing, that I'm allowed to take one thing at a time, and I didn't have to live anymore like 10 years behind me or 10 years in the future. I could just live right here in the now. And that was just not something that I was familiar with at that point. So that's why I say life changing.
I love that, Vance. I do want to actually ask you a question related to that first yoga session, because it sounds like that made such an indelible impression upon you that you came home and were having a conversation with Amy about that. Can you expound on that? What, and maybe put words to what some of those things were, what you experienced in there, for our listeners to really say, hey, this could be something to help me. I mean, it, one and done for you. You're like, oh, you did one session. I'm all in.
I'm not going to tell. No, I mean, I will say after the first one, I had some very good experience out of that first one. And most of us would say, you know, the idea of like sitting still and just allowing yourself to be, that's one of the most uncomfortable things that I can ask you to do.
And hell no.
Like, I can't do that. And that's why everybody, whenever you talk about meditation, everybody's like, that's stupid. But if you can take a different approach to that, which is, you know, you heard all those things that I was saying to myself. And so why are you doing that? Like, why was I being so self-critical? So what it allowed me to do, that first yoga practice, and the reason it was so impactful was, A, it slows my mind down and allows me to just be still and literally just accept exactly what's going on right now in my body, in my mind. It allowed me to empty out some of those terrible emotions. And let me put it this way. So very early on in my yoga career, I heard a teacher say to let that shit go. And what they were talking about is we were in like a forward fold. So they were like, you know, imagine all that stuff that you carry around with you on a daily basis and where it just feels heavy on your shoulders, or maybe it's just like weighing you down in your head. So when you're kind of like upside down, imagine that that stuff is just falling off your shoulders and falling out of the top of your head. Let that shit go. And it just resonated with me. And like still to this day, I'll use that in some of my classes. And that's why. It's because, you know, somebody else said it to me and I was like, wow, that's incredible. Because you don't have to walk around with it anymore. And you only hurt yourself by holding on to it.
I love that. So you enter into this yoga journey immediately diving headlong in it. How quickly were you seeing some lasting implications of practicing yoga?
So I'll say in the beginning, I was probably doing it 3 to 4 times a week. And that was in like the first month. And in the first month, I'm not going to say that you'll be fixed after one yoga class, but I think like in anything that I've learned through this wellness journey, is that you have to keep up with all of it. And it's an ongoing journey. So I still to this day will practice 3 to 4 times a week. And now what yoga looks like for me now is probably a little different. I used to go to a hot studio all the time. So it was a little more fitness based and faster paced and, you know, listening to like hard rock and rap. And I used to, and sometimes I just want a chill class, or sometimes I want like a yin class where we don't move barely at all. I just have come to know many different types of it at this point, but all of it is yoga, because all of it is taking this component of your breath and then matching it to whatever posture that you come to. And that's the idea. It's getting you out of your head and getting you back into your body. And that's not a place that we like to be sometimes. We like to get kind of wrapped up in our mind. And that's when we maybe start to chase our thoughts or chase our emotions. And maybe if you can take that pause and get yourself back in your body and you can realize where you feel with whatever you're doing, I think you start to make some realizations and you don't maybe, make some assumptions and jump off the deep end. That's for me anyway. That's the kind of stuff that you're
Well, me. I certainly want to spend a little bit of time talking about the concept of yoga and the benefits of, yoga and breath work, mindfulness, wherever you want to go. But I don't want to leave your story too quickly. I mean, there's a rest of the story here that is, I mean, you seem at peace. When I first met you, you had a smile on your face. You had a joy and a presence and energy about you that was, I still remember that. And how do you get from, I don't necessarily want to commit suicide, but I'm not okay with living to today. Right. I mean, this is probably more than a yoga journey, but
Yeah. It's really a wellness, and healing mm-hmm. journey is the way it is. And, I'm not saying everybody has to do yoga. I'm just saying that's what worked for me. And, I will tell you that, it became so impactful in my sobriety journey because it gave me something to focus on, something where I wasn't like, I need to go to a liquor store and I need to buy something. I need a drink. I was like, oh, okay, well, maybe I'll just go to a class. And it just gave me a different avenue. So the reason that I want to bring it into the first responder population is, we just work with all this stress all the time. And some of it is just because of the jobs that we do. And then some of it is just kind of put on us because of the environment we work in, meaning like the people we work with and the people we work for. The interesting just in the things that I've learned about in the last couple of years is the amount of trauma that we're just exposed to. And I know that, a lot of us were like adrenaline junkies and we can't imagine doing anything else. And we were like, yeah, I want to do this job because it's super cool. But nobody ever thought about what does this do to your mind? Because it's not like our brain is mapped any different than the person that works at the bank or, the person that's like checking me out at the 7-Eleven, something like that. So there has to be something that we do that mitigates the amount of trauma and the amount of stress that we go through. That's what yoga did for me, is it allowed me to get out of that fight or flight response. And it allowed me to start to be in a safe place in my own body so that I can start to process the things that had happened. Now, I'm not going to tell you that yoga alone is where that happened. A lot of that happens because not only am I doing that, but I'm also not drinking. I'm going to therapy on a weekly basis. I'm taking medicine for my head. Later on, I start learning about cold plunges. I learn about Reiki and energy healing. And so there's such a buffet of options that I can pick and choose. And I'm not going to tell you that I like everything, but there's certain things that have become my go-to that I'm going to do that make my body right. And more importantly, make my mind right. So the interesting thing is how important sleep really becomes into this whole thing. So I was like everybody else. I worked shift work for a lot of years. So I would work overnight. I would sleep like 2 or 3 hours during the day. And then I would live on energy drinks the next day. And, all of a sudden I would just be a prick. And I wonder why. Well, it's because I got 3 hours of sleep. That's why. So a lot of people will tell you that, at night they just can't settle down and they can't make their mind like slow. So that's where yoga and that's where meditation and that's where some of these other wellness practices allow your body to get to a place where they can start to file and process what has happened throughout their day so that you can settle and you can allow your body to rest for, you know, 7 to 9 hours, let's say ish. I know there's people that will tell me that they only need 4 or 5 to function, but I'm just saying the older we get, the more we need. And there got to be a place in my 30s that I couldn't sleep during the day anymore. I just couldn't. And I imagine that probably had to do with the fact that I wasn't doing anything to take care of my body or my mind. I wasn't like involved in any sort of wellness practice. And my coping mechanism was bought at your local liquor store. So that's probably why, something to do with that. But so I've started talking not just about yoga, but about wellness in general and why therapy is not a bad thing and why sleep's important for you. And like central nervous system regulation and things like that. So that's kind of been like the last year or so. It's not just been about teaching yoga classes, although, you know, I certainly do that. And then the most recent thing that I've started to do is I set these like 2-hour blocks up, and the first 45 minutes or so is I tell people a shorter version of my story, because I think it connects with a lot of people. And I think a lot more people are struggling than what are willing to admit. And if you hear me say it, maybe you're more apt to be like, oh my God, I'm going down that road. How do I maybe step off before I get to this catastrophe? And then I teach them a yoga class. And if they like it, you know, listen, I'll certainly teach Zoom. I'm going to start to teach locally here again shortly. I just want to show people that it's, you don't have to just keep doing the same thing over and over again and hope for a different result. There are a lot of other things that we can do that can maybe start to help us and heal us.
You definitely have hit on a great topic that I love visiting about, which is sleep. The concept of sleep, I just can't say enough about how important it is to sleep and get rest in the amount of hours that you need. It varies for most bodies, but you did bring up a point that you know, people in our profession, specifically fire law, that somehow they've become okay with allowing themselves to just do 3, 4, 5 hours and have that as, that's all I need. And that's not true. There's so many reasons to as why that's not true, but we can deep dive in any one of those. But the reality is, I lean a lot on Matthew Walker's book, Why We Sleep, when it comes to that. And he made a pretty significant I think most of his research is based upon the medical community, but it resonates mm-hmm. with everyone. It resonates with all of us that. Yeah. I'll probably mess this statistic up, but the percentage number of people who can sleep or operate unimpaired on a daily basis on less than 6 hours of sleep a night, rounded to a whole number, is zero. I mean, I heard it on a Joe Rogan interview. I immediately bought the book and read the book. Yeah. Now, what I would like to bring out, and maybe you can offer up your 2 cents on worth on it, because I think it's probably where you're going with this, is in that book, he talks a lot about sleep hygiene and being intentional, because we are not intentional. Our society is not intentional about sleep. There are cultures mm-hmm. around the world that are intentional about sleep and recognize how, but we're not one of them. And within mm-hmm. our community specifically, you know, of first responders, and veterans, we are not intentional about sleep. And at the very core of the amount of trauma, sleep has a humongous impact on parking that trauma where it's supposed to live if it entered into, and that's why you have things like EMDR and ART and the brain spotting, these things that actually can take that trauma from the amygdala, the reptilian portion, and put it in the prefrontal, that's supposed to, that can be done by REM sleep, right? So I love the topic, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on your version or your insight into this, because it, we could spend a lot of time on this, and this is fabulous. Let's see where we go.
No, I can remember when I did a presentation late last year all about, and honestly, I called it, why you need to sleep more than Buddy the Elf, because there's a point in the movie Elf where they're like, how did you sleep last night? He's like, great. I got a full 40 minutes. And I swear that's, I mean, like, how many cops have I ever worked with?
It's all I need. Like,
and that. we would pride ourselves, right? Right. That we could go on 3 or 4 hours.
Well, right. And you're like, I'm so busy. I'll sleep when I'm dead. One of the really interesting statistics that I've seen in, when you start to like analyze sleep and lack of sleep, moreover, was if you go 19 hours without sleeping, your cognitive ability is to the point of actually being legally drunk. And then if you go 24 hours, you're actually over the legal limit. So, you know, the thing that I always would leave people with is, listen, every single one of your agencies probably has a carry policy on, you can have your gun on you if you have like a beer, but if you're impaired, then you can't. What's the difference? You're impaired. It's just you're impaired because you refuse to sleep, not because, you know, of an intoxicant or something like that. So, and I can think to myself, the longest shift I ever worked, that I was on the clock for 19 hours. That's not how long I was awake. I was working for 19. I mean, I had probably been up for a couple hours prior to that. I was probably up for maybe an hour after I got off, but I mean, it was nothing for me that when I would work a night shift rotation, that when I would wake up, let's say I was going to work tonight, I would have gotten up this morning and then done whatever during the day and then just stay up overnight. And I would be miserable by about 4 o'clock in the morning, and energy drinks, coffee. And then all those things. And then by the time I need to settle and I need to sleep, I can't, because I have so much caffeine coursing through my body that I can't settle. And it's the reason that you have that disturbed sleep. So then you don't sleep very much, but then you have to go back to night shift again. It's a horrible cycle to just be on this constantly. And, you know, at some point you're like, yeah, I just need to catch up on sleep. And what are you going to do? Sleep for 24 hours? Maybe, but...
Now you not only have ingredients of what you're drinking, you have a chemical imbalance, you have a hormone imbalance, and your body's saying, what is going on? Truth be told, on some levels, you start getting into some survival mode stuff where your nervous system just takes over, and you start having cortisol dump. I mean, it gets crazy. But to your point, in Matthew Walker's book, he said, you can never catch up on sleep. You can't catch up on sleep, even though there's a common misunderstanding of that, well, if I slept 6 hours last night, I'll just sleep 12 or 14 tonight. It does not work. Right. Our bodies don't work like
that. I mean, I lived a lot of years of my life thinking that I could just make it up when I'm off and stuff like that. But now, and you started to go down this route, and I'm going to talk to you about it. And it's stuff you probably know, but I'm going to share with listeners, as far as sleep hygiene goes. Listen, every night at 7:45, my phone goes to sleep. No more notifications. I'm not going to tell you that I get off my phone. I love to tell people you shouldn't use phones or TV like an hour before bed. I violate the shit out of that. But it's my reminder that, hey, it's wind down. So I try to be in bed like 8:30, 9 o'clock every night. And then I get up early. I am like getting up between 4 and 5 every morning. And like the first thing that I do is like, I get up and I do something physical, whether that be a yoga class, like that I'll do it at my house, or I'll lift weights, walk the dogs. I have to move my body for 30 minutes, enough that it makes my heart go up, makes me sweat maybe a little bit. But that's how my day has to start. That's just what I've learned about me. So a lot of that has to, if I don't go to sleep on time, then I'm not going to be able to wake up at the time that I want to and be able to get my day started right. So there's that component. The other part is, I mean, like the blackout blinds in the bedroom, trying to make it as cold as we can. I have a noise machine that runs all the time. I have a 35-pound like weighted blanket that sleeps on top of me. And then probably a dog or two is also going to sleep on top of me. So also fine.
Out of all the trinkets and tricks and shit that we buy as cops and firefighters, because we're all in on spending money on these little trinkets for work.
Mm-hmm.
We seldom devote money towards our wellness. And I love the concept of where you're talking about in this discussion, because you're talking about the totality, but if you centralize it to sleep again, and I don't want to leave this topic too quick because it's such a great conversation. You're investing money financially in your sleep. Matthew Walker, actually, I keep going back to that book because it made a huge impression on me. He made the comment. He said, this is the greatest life hack we have, and it's free.
Yeah.
And I would argue it's not necessarily free. The cost is you have to be intentional. You have to do something in the evening. You have to not eat after 8 o'clock. You have to, you know, not drink coffee. And each body is different. I've found my sweet spot for that, but blue light on the phone and, you know, dark room and temperature, you know, there's just so many variables to that, but I think there's such a lack of intentionality within our first responder community in looking for what makes me sleep better. I just feel like we do not talk about this enough, and we certainly don't do it enough.
I took a train.
And I was in the same boat. I used to do that. But a lot of that, if we add in drinking, that was some of my, I just need to drink a little bit to go to sleep. Well, a little bit was like a lot.
Right.
But
I can remember I can remember actually learning from, it was a coworker's father who was a retired police corporal at the time. And he told us that when you get off at 8 o'clock in the morning, the thing that'll put you to sleep is two beers, and you probably won't get through the second beer. And I mean, I was 22 years old when I heard that, and I was like, all right, well, I mean,
he said it.
If this is what works for the older cops, fuck it, let's go. But I, you know, I wish somebody would, I wish we would stop glorifying productiveness and like lack of sleep and like doing all these things that actually end up hurting you in the long run, just for the sake of like doing more. You know, so when I go back to yoga, the idea that you're literally doing nothing. And when's the last time that you allowed yourself to accept that I'm doing nothing and I'm allowed to be still? And most people, that's why they get really uncomfortable with that, because they get real fidgety and they're like, I'm not supposed to sit still because somebody taught me that I'm supposed to be moving and being productive all the time, and all I'm doing is wasting time. I was there. So I get it.
Makes sense. The sorry, Max, go ahead.
No, I took a training one time, and the guy talked about sleep, and he said the safest, most productive shift for law enforcement is an 8-hour shift. And he says, but all of law enforcement hates 8-hour shifts. They want the 12-hour shifts because we get more days off. And he says, it's almost impossible for you to go home at the end of your 12-hour shift, have the wind down time, actually get enough sleep before you have to be up again for your next shift. He says, it's impossible. He says, but if you tried to go back to 8-hour shifts, you'd just see an absolute uproar in law enforcement across the country. They'd lose their minds.
People would lose their minds. But I'm going to tell you one more thing while we're talking about sleep and we're talking about shifts. The first agency that I worked for, so when I first got out of college, I worked for the city of Salisbury, and I worked there for a year and a half total. And we would do day shift for 2 weeks, 12-hour shifts, and then we'd do night shift for 2 weeks. And like at this time, Amy and I were dating, and she's like, when do you work? Because I can't keep this straight. And I literally would have to like map it out and be like, oh, okay, well, I'm working overnight that day. But you never felt like your body was coming or going, because I mean, talk about putting your entire life schedule like on a deer every 2 weeks. It's awful.
That is rough.
No consistency.
Well, my from experiential standpoint, my work in the road shifts were 6 p.m. to 2 a.m. on a 5-day set. My first shift would be 6 p.m. to 2 a. The next one would be 4 p.m. to midnight. The next one would be a 2 p.m. to 10. The next one would be an 8 a. to 4 p.m. And the fifth one would be a 6 a.m. to 2 p.m. And then you did that on purpose. Yeah. So you'd have extra time off. You could almost squeeze a full day in there. And there was a time period there where I had, I was broke. This was back in the 90s. We didn't have any money. So I worked two part-time jobs on top of that. Yeah. And, there was no sleep. And again, the old timers were like, this is just a way of life. You need to get used to it. Drink more coffee. And like, this is crazy.
And maybe there is a better way, but a lot of times unfortunately there was this old guard that was just like, why are you guys complaining about this? It's been like this forever. Just know your place.
You're not going to change it.
Okay. Well, why can't we make it better? And I mean, like, policing is going to be around for a while, you know, why don't we make it better for the people that are still around and still wanting to do this job? Cause God bless them.
Well, I do want to offer up one, maybe this statistic will get us back on the wellness conversation. I love the fact that we deep dove a little bit into sleep, because I'm really passionate about that. But the math for us doesn't work. If we don't change the math doesn't work. The average life expectancy for citizens in the United States is 78. The average life expectancy for law enforcement is 57. So that math doesn't work. So you can say all you want about this is the way we've always done it. If you want to live longer, you're going to have to do something different. So,
hey, I'm going to add, I want to add on to your stat, because I think this one's eye opening. And I heard this years ago when I was doing a wellness project for a supervisor school, and it was the life expectancy of a police officer post retirement was 5 years. And I'm thinking to myself, well, that's not worth it. I mean, I'm no kind of math person. I'm not some sort of like numbers whiz or anything like that, but putting 25, 30 years into something for a net of 5 years, what's the point? So many of us are like, I'll take care of it when I'm retired. I'll take care of it when I get to the end of the road. Well, the reason this is so important is, what are you going to look like at the end of your road? Because, look, if I'm just going to use me for an example. If I just stay mad all the time and I just stay drinking constantly, who's to say that I don't wreck my professional career? Who's to say that I don't wreck my Amy's just like, you know what, dude, you don't want to help yourself? I'm out of here. The things don't start to fall apart. Hey, it's cool because I still got a job and a couple more years, then I'll take care of myself. But what's left? Right? So that's why I'm so focused now on people that are actually still in the working force, because you're going to change whether you like it or not. The person that you go in at 22, 23, whatever the age is that you went into the job, you're going to look different when you come out. It's just how different.
And it's going to end. The job's going to end no matter what.
Awesome point. Awesome.
So what is there after?
Yes.
I feel like that's why some of those guys work for 40, 45, 50 years, because they know that statistic. Right. I've got to work longer because I'm only going to live 5 years after I retire.
Right. So if I just keep working, I just can't die. But a lot of the thing, and I say this when I teach people, is look, there is somebody in that uniform that's not your life. That's not what you're defined by, that badge or that uniform. There's somebody in there that has like thoughts and opinions and hopes and dreams. And how do we get back to that?
Well, I know you're staring at retirement, and I'm excited for you in it. And mm-hmm. I love that. And congratulations. You're almost there.
That's right.
I will tell you, once you retire, they don't give two shits about you. They will fill your badge number. They'll give your uniform, conceptually, not the one you're wearing, but your uniform is going to be filled by somebody else. They're going to, it's government service. It's agency service. It's unit service. They're going to fill it. They're going to love you and pat you on the back, hopefully, and say, hey, thanks for playing. Have a good life. And then that void will be immediately filled. And this buying all in to, I've got to do the work for 10, 12, 14, 16 hours a day because it's so important to the agency. That's a lie we tell ourselves. But I want to circle us back here to yoga, because I do want to give, as we kind of start looking to the end of this, if you were going to help steer someone to yoga, because it's and I have my own experiences with yoga. I'll just give you this little bit of a tidbit to kind of stage this up. When I went through Chateau, that's when I actually first learned the importance of yoga. Now I still do mindfulness meditation. I just don't do yoga as much, even though it was awesome for me. I tried it a lot. I found that the meditation practice, that's one of my morning rituals as well, is mm-hmm. spending some mm-hmm. time within, just being silent, being present, and acknowledging, you know, what the day is going to be. But there is this, I call it hippie shit. There is this concept of it's just dumb, or it's just stupid, or it's not for me, or maybe even to be more gender specific, it's just for women, or, you know, there's no doubt in this journey you've encountered all of these and probably more questions and arguments against doing it, if not contentious attitudes towards, that can't help me. Something so simple, that can't help me. Can you speak to a little bit of that?
So, I mean, for those people that need like research, I mean, you're talking about something that's scientifically backed that will actually create new neural pathways inside your mind and inside your brain. So, you know, we can talk about that. Now, a lot of it is, and 10 years ago, I probably would have had the same opinion. And I would have been like, well, I just don't want to do it. So I'm going to come up with every opinion. I'm going to come up with all the other things. And I'm going to say, I can't touch my toes. And I'm going to say, it's just for girls. And I'm going to say that it's tippy dippy shit. Because I'm just so uncomfortable. So the difference here is, in order for you to grow, you have to be challenged. You have to go outside of your comfort zone. And when you keep staying in that same circle, that same thing that you do over and over again, you're never going to get better, and you're never going to.
That's right.
So, again, what happened when I finally got past my own thought and went into a yoga studio? Well, it was incredibly life changing. I used to say that losing my career, it kind of took away my passion and purpose. And coming into a yoga studio and deciding that I want to teach this to other people just like me, it gave me my passion and purpose back. And I'll do this for a long time to come. And it won't probably be just yoga teaching, but just talking about wellness and talking about other ways to maybe take care of your body and your mind. But again, I feel passionate about it. This is not something that I learned about in a book. This is something that I experienced myself, and getting to share it with other people that are just like me has been great. And what I love to share with you guys is, you know, every time I talk about this publicly, and I talk about my struggles with alcohol, I talk about my struggles with mental health, I usually get like a tug on the shirt sleeve, and somebody's like, can I talk to you? And it's usually like, me too. And I didn't think other people were like this. And that's where I was. When I told you that I was in that deep, deep hole and I didn't figure out a way, I was down in that hole by myself. I didn't think other people were messed up like me. And I didn't think anybody was going to understand me. The fact of the matter is, man, it's a lot of people that are struggling, that are having some issues. You just got to know that there's all kinds of people that will support you. There's all kinds of people that will reach down in that hole, or maybe they'll even put that ladder down in the hole and help you get out. You just got to be willing to take that first step.
You're touching on it a little bit. I mean, and we're hearing your success story. But I mean, do you have, since you've been doing first responder yoga and teaching it, you have a success story that kind of stands out to you? You have one that maybe is more impactful than others?
So I've had a couple that some folks, much like myself, that were self-medicating. And so I, when they heard my story, they started to try yoga along with me. And they'll actually speak to, they now go and tell other police officers, like, this is incredible. Like, whatever you have in your mind that you think, like, hey, yoga's stupid, no, just come try it. It's not going to be weird. It's just, it's a little bit of breath work, a little bit of movement, and some music. That's it. I'm not chanting. I'm not, incense and all that business, but it's just, I try to break it down to make it as simple as possible for people to be able to get the benefits from it.
I love that. Well, I would love to actually spend a little bit of time on the neuro pathway portion as well. If we have a few minutes here, if you don't mind speaking to it, I actually had a ketamine doctor on recently, but we ended up in a rabbit hole of neuropathways and neuroplasticity. And one of the things that we talked about is this dopamine effect of chasing this dopamine and alcohol is part of that, whatever that addiction piece and those we start forming those pathways. And one of the metaphors he used was a sled in a snow. And he said, the more, more dug out those ruts are for your sled, the smoother and faster it will go. And that's how the neuroplasticity, that's a very modest definition and metaphor for a neural pathway, but it's true. I mean, when we start, some of these are just off a little bit and we can start reconnecting them and growing them and making them stronger. Is that fair?
Or if you start to think a different way and you use this coping mechanism, and that's where addiction comes from. This is now maybe forging a new one that you can start to problem solve and you can start to feel again, which is another thing that we don't really talk about, that because in the police academy and because, majority of us are boys, like we don't have feelings and we don't cry and, all these things. And yoga actually gives you this safe space for an hour that you can allow your body to actually feel again. Which sounds like when I say that, like I hadn't felt, like, cause I would push everything down as far as I possibly can and just hope it never comes back and really hope that's what it is to be a man. And you don't understand the damage that you're actually doing. Now, creating the ability to create that neural pathway that, when you feel uncomfortable, when you feel pain, to not run from it, and not try to numb it, but to just be with it and just stay there and just maybe take a breath. You have created this new pathway where the mind doesn't have to run away just because it's uncomfortable. And that's pretty amazing in and of itself, that you can do that for
through yourself. Experience. I know how valuable that is, just that you can actually know and experience this whatever that emotion and leaning into it creates a pathway of freedom in essence of I'm not held hostage to this pain or I'm working out of being held hostage to this pain. It's amazing, and I wish we had more time to dive in it, but Vance, thank you so much for coming on the No One Fights Alone podcast. If somebody wants to get a hold of you or find you, or maybe talk to you more about Yoga Rescue. How would they do that?
Great. Best way is my website, and it's yoga-rescue.com. And through that is my phone number. You can shoot me an email. You can find me on all the social accounts. So yoga-rescue.
And then one quick last plug for yoga. If somebody wanted to get started, what would you encourage them to do? Where would you send them? How to get started?
Oh my God. The first place I would send you is go to YouTube. There's so many free yoga classes. And I'll tell you, the person that I usually refer people to is this Yoga with Adrienne. I think the way that she does like 10 minute classes, 15 minutes, 30 minutes, 60 minutes. She has what is really good for beginners and starters. I have a YouTube channel, but I don't have the content that she has. So I like to always say, you know, sometimes she'll do like 10 minutes for your hips or like 15 minutes for your shoulders or something like that. It's just a really nice introduction into yoga. And then if you like that, you can certainly start to deep dive and find some other people, but that's the one I tell people to start.
Vance, do they have a module that has yoga for driving in 2 foot of snow? Oh, and we lost Max. We lost Max at the very time I'm picking on him.
Right. Right.
Hey, Vance, it has been an absolute pleasure to have you on, and thank you for sharing your story. Thank you for sharing your passion. Thank you for educating us a little more on all facets of wellness, not just yoga, but wow, a big shout out to you and your Yoga Rescue, your passion and your mission. Thank you for doing what you do.
Awesome. Thank you guys. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Vance.
Chateau Health and Wellness is a 16-bed treatment facility nestled in the foothills of the Wasatch Mountains in Midway, Utah. Chateau's First Responder Resiliency Program is designed to treat the unique challenges and issues that first responders encounter in the course of their careers. Chateau's comprehensive and highly individualized approach to treatment addresses more than just the presenting issues. It addresses the why. Each of their seasoned, trauma-trained, and culturally competent therapists utilize evidence-based, specialized therapies to treat trauma at its core and enable clients to begin the healing process while developing a resilient and healthy relationship with stress. Chateau Health and Wellness is trusted by departments and agencies from around the country to treat responders and veterans. In fact, it is one of only a handful of facilities nationwide that is vetted and approved to treat members of the Fraternal Order of Police. For more information or to speak to a representative, go to chateaurecovery.com or call 888-507-5031.